As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Our first guest this morning is Dominic Constant. He's Managing Director at Deutsche Bank Global Head of Interest Rates Research, and he joins us now in the studio. Good morning. Great to see you.
Good morning.
Let me start with a broad question, and that is when you're looking at the curve, when you're looking at rates, how much has that forecast changed in light of, say, what we heard from Mario Draghi last week, all of the chorus we've heard from Federal Reserve policymakers as well? Has it changed much here over these last few months?
Yeah. I mean, we were around the Brexit period, we were very constructive on rates, and we had a target of 125 for tens and a flatter yield curve. And basically, we think low rates became too much of a sort of a bad thing from the central bank perspective, especially at the long end. They felt that the yield curve was too flat, was creating problems in the entitlement industry, creating challenges for, say, banks, because they tend to like steeper yield curves. And so I think you've seen this sort of jawboning exercise whereby they want to basically get the long rates up a little bit. And that's not because they want to tighten monetary conditions per se, but they'd like a little bit of extra risk premium in there that can help entitlement people like the insurers. And there's also maybe an element whereby the hunt for yield, whereby investors who might otherwise buy bonds end up being pushed into riskier assets by those instead, and maybe create some kind of overvaluation in those asset classes. That's perhaps a concern. So I think whether you agree with it or not, that's what the central bankers have been sort of aiming at. And the BOJ targeted the 10-year yield, stop it going up or down. The ECB's, you know, mumbling about taper, whether or not you really believe it. And obviously the Fed is pushing on with what they hope to be able to do is raise rates in December.
Looking at Treasuries in specific, is the long end attractive to you right now at all?
I think it depends on your horizon, yeah, and obviously, you know, your view. I mean, my view is it's getting attractive. It's not quite there yet. I'd like to sort of basically buy 10-year treasuries, you know, above 2%. I think it can probably go there. But you're going to be buying it over 2% with a view it's going to come back down again to around 1.5, or if not 1.25, based on what we have is some sort of disappointing growth expectations, especially in the U.S. Over the next year.
Who are the Fed policymakers that you listen to most closely? Of course, you listen to Chair Yellen and Vice Chair Fisher, but of the others, who's saying stuff that's the most materially interesting to you?
Well, I think what's interesting is obviously sort of not necessarily anyone in particular, but more the sort of general sort of, you know, consensus outside the sort of Yellen-Fisher equation. And so you see, for example, some of the hawks who were speaking maybe at the beginning of last year, you could happily ignore them. Then suddenly you see sort of some more dovish members, perhaps, you know, like Rosengren or Evans, sort of, you know, moving towards some of those viewpoints, and then suddenly Dudley sort of, you know, pops up again and says, you know, 10-year yields are too low. So you know, things like that I think catch my attention, and then you know that there's some pressure. You know, we know, you know, Yellen is obviously, you know, very much on the sort of dovish side, classically speaking, but you know there's some sort of pressure. And I think it's like we kind of all agree, you know, we all would like to see higher rates, but I think the idea is you know, whether they have the guts to do it, and that kind of you know, depends on what this sort of you know, significant, you know, minority sort of ends up.
Yeah. Dominic, you're talking there about a more cautious view of where interest rates will go lower for longer and everything hunkering down, GDP estimates and such. When we do the dots,
if we're going to continue to do the dots, what is the constant long term that they should be looking at? Is long term March of 2017? Is long term where it is right now? Or should they go out, because of your view, to 2020 and make a guesstimate out there?
Well, I mean, I think long term is right now, you know, we're thinking long term sort of around, you know, obviously the sort of, you know, 2 or 3 years from now. I think the issue that we have in this sort of growth cycle is it's more of a stagnation rather than a recession. And what that means is that there's no sort of imminent sort of exogenous shock that's being sort of applied to the economy that's suddenly going to sort of turn this cycle. And it's kind of like a slow bleed, but we see the nature of the slow bleed. It's the idea that, you know, as you hit full employment and you almost go beyond what we consider full employment, there's no sort of natural response of higher wages and all that kind of stuff, or productivity kicking in at a higher level, and that means you know, this long term really can be sort of out to that sort of 2, 3, 4, you know, 5 years. But the probabilities are such that you effectively will you know, there will be some negative shock somewhere in that time horizon, and that's right. Where, you know, they're done raising rates, basically.
You stated earlier this morning the idea that there would be negative rates for longer. Does that leak over to a Carney United Kingdom that's saying, no, we'll never do negative rates? Is it even imaginable that Yellen and her follow-on will have to consider negative rates?
Well, I definitely think the U.S. will have to consider negative rates on a 5-10 year view, just because once this cycle really is finished, what's the choice? You're going to cut rates a couple of times, because that's, you know, they won't have risen them that far, or you go back to these extraordinary measures on quantitative easing, which I think, you know, have their own issues around them. So my guess is it's probably going to be a combination of both, and the market will definitely think about negative rates. There are lots of legal issues for negative rates in the States, though, so those have to be addressed. But it's a different issue in terms of the market being able to perhaps price in terms of market expectations, they could price them. I think the UK is different, because the UK is obviously can have an extremely weak currency. It's having a weak currency. It can import inflation quite readily on that basis. It's something that the US, you know, can't do. The US is a very large economy. It's relatively insular. We have a reserve currency, so by all means, we can try and get our currency down at the expense of the rest of the world. But even then, we're not going to import that much inflation, you know, because the service sector can hold it up. So I think, you know, that's a difference. I mean, so the UK can perhaps avoid negative rates if they just collapse their currency. And one of the arguments for Japan and the Eurozone is they've found it very hard to collapse, you know, their currencies.
Right. Interesting.
Catalytically, what would be more powerful here for rates? Something out of the Bank of Japan or the ECB, a change in either of those banks?
Well, I mean, we've actually had a little buzzword recently whereby we've been arguing that sort of Japan has kind of almost become the marginal pricer of global assets. And they've done that because obviously there have been, you know, significant outflows out of Japan. I mean, they are a very big investor. But it's really through the JGB yield curve. Their yield curve absolutely collapsed earlier this year as interest rates came down. And that kind of forced a lot of money to come out of Japan into other bond markets. And it's all part and parcel of the quantitative easing that they're doing, and also to some extent the negative rates that they've employed. That works through something we call the cross-currency basis that got very extreme, which is kind of the cost to the Japanese investor of hedging their overseas purchases. So we've been monitoring that very carefully, and you can sort of see the influence they have on yields. And that's why when we talk about risk premium going away in our markets, we can actually sort of directly link it back to what the Japanese investor base is doing. And I think, you know, if I was the Fed and you're sort of saying, well, you know, risk premium going away in the markets isn't great because it may lead to financial stability issues, you know, maybe you want to reverse that a little bit.
Dominic, not to get you in trouble with Mr. Crine or compliance, but with your many, many contacts over the year in London, what is the constant thought on the future of finance and Wall Street in London?
Well, I mean, my guess is that the London financial sector will figure it out, in the sense that, you know, London has always figured it out, so that it won't be nearly as draconian as, you know, as people sort of perhaps fear. I mean, obviously, right now, I mean, the whole concern around this sort of passporting is a great concern, and there are incentives clearly for the Europeans to, you know, to take back certain banking functions and sort of in terms of clearing and things like that in the Eurozone. But my guess is that, you know, that there will be, you know, that London is too rich a centre for financial talent, and they have all the incentives to try and work around whatever restrictions.
That talent was schooled on certain theories. And Stan Fisher, at his recent Economic Club of New York speech, talking of the IS curve, back to Hicks 39. It's a different world today, I guess. Are you using the theories you learned, or is it a new world for you as you think every day and try to piece the system together?
Well, we're sort of relying on the theories that we've learned. I mean, I go back to Thatcher when she was this sort of great, quote, pro-European. She knew exactly what she was doing in terms of putting the London at the center of the financial world and all the benefits that that was going to bring with it. And, you know, for all the sort of headline news around these negotiations, I mean, why would, you know, why would London or the British want to, you know, shoot themselves in the foot? It just doesn't make sense. So I think there's a lot of posturing going on at the moment. But I'd be shocked if there was in London was no longer what it currently is.
We talk a lot about banks thinking of moving headquarters or offices overseas. But among your friends and colleagues, is there conversation about that, about leaving London because of the sentiment in the place? Has that changed at all since the vote?
No, not so obviously. I mean, to be honest, I think there's a lot of people sort of, you know, still can't believe the outcome of the vote. I mean, remember, London itself was overwhelmingly in favour, you know, of staying within the European Union. So, you know, I think obviously there are people who are concerned that if they don't have a, you know, British passport, what does that mean? And, you know, there's definitely, you know, some people running off and making sure they're getting their British passports. I mean, you hear that from sort of some colleagues. But in general, no, I think there's still somewhat a sort of disbelief that this is actually happening. And this is why I think the Tory government is trying to sort of insist that, you know, Brexit really means Brexit, because it might be very easy for people to think, well, you know, maybe it doesn't actually mean that. And so that's why they're sort of having to approach this in a hard way. So we'll see what happens next year when they finally decide, if and when they finally decide to pull the trigger on the article.
From that referendum to the election here in the States, how much is the campaign, how much is the election weighing on forecasting rates at this point?
You mean the election in the
US?
Yeah. Well, I think it could have weighed much more. And to some extent, perhaps it still does weigh. But if there was a sort of shake-up in terms of the political sort of outlook in terms of gridlock. So obviously, you know, there is a view that if there was a clean sweep, particularly by the Republicans, but perhaps by the Democrats, then maybe gridlock would end, and that could change your outlook. I think if there's ongoing gridlock, I think people are going to say more of the same. And unfortunately, more of the same is from an economic perspective, and certainly from a financial market perspective is a bit disappointing, because it's going to mean more financial repression, low volatility, you know, regardless of your views on the actual, you know, parties. I mean, we don't really want more of the same. That's a problem.
Dominic, thank you so much. Very generous of you to be with us for these hours this morning here at Bloomberg. He is with Deutsche Bank, Dominic Konstam, writing just terrific notes. And the main theme I heard there, folks, is a real subdued view on rate structure forward, on where yields are going.
Well, Apple reported earnings yesterday after the bell, and we're drawn to the forecast of sales for the next quarter. Apple saying they'll be between $76 billion and $78 billion. Analysts had expected $75.4 billion. For more, we're joined by Walter Piecyk. He's an analyst with BTIG. Walter, always great to speak with you.
Thanks. Great to be back on.
So the question going into this, I think, was, would Samsung's loss here, all the trouble caused by the problems with the Galaxy Note 7, become Apple's gain? And what did we learn from the report yesterday and in the conference calls about that?
Yeah, and I think the answer is kind of. And by the way, we also heard some feedback from some of the operators that reported before Apple did. And I think my initial view was, or I guess question was, if someone was buying a high-end Android phone, do they just stick within that ecosystem because that's what they were used to? And I think what we've been hearing is that they have actually seen switchers, because there's not, particularly on the larger models, like the 7 Plus versus the Note, that they were actually pulling these people in, which is actually really good news. If Apple can get them in their own ecosystem and the customer's pleased with it, it becomes sticky on their end, and it's going to be harder for Android, whatever vendor wants to get that customer back, to pull them back. So whether it was the operators earlier in the week or what Apple was saying on their call, it sounds like they are benefiting. Now, I just want to put one pause on all this is you can't get a 7 Plus right now, right? The ship dates are not out until end of the year. So their own inability to ramp up the volumes on the 7 Plus, maybe because they didn't expect this mix shift to happen, might limit how much that they can benefit. So I think they really need to focus on getting those volumes up to grab, you know, more and more of those Samsung customers that just don't have a product right now.
I know Tom is waiting for his 7. Let me ask you, Walt, about the way that Tim Cook's Apple keeps people in that ecosystem. It's through services, I imagine. And what color did we get yesterday about how Apple's been improving its services? Obviously, there were problems with Apple Music and its other offerings. Has that improved? Have we seen that stabilize?
That's been fine. Look, the new messaging is great. It had really lagged behind other third-party applications. So that was, for one, important because, look, if you're texting all of your friends and it works well, you're less likely to leave if you need to stay on an Apple phone to do that. But even before things like that, the company for years has been focused on when you're near your computer or your iPad or things like that, you know, all these services kind of transfer. They do whatever they can to keep you in so that they get your upgrade every 2 years or however long it ends up being.
Are they getting that upgrade? What is the character of the upgrade? When you talk to Apple bears, do they actually believe that people won't upgrade, that they'll sit on the phone for an extra 6 hours or 6 months?
Those bears have had their day, I think, for the past year, because those upgrade rates were clearly extending if you looked at how the numbers were. But what's been surprising, and frankly reflected on this rally in the stock, you know, over the past couple of months, has been that the upgrades have actually come in for this phone. I mean, everyone, think about this months ago, right? Everyone's saying, oh, this is not really that great, we're going to wait till next year. And now the operators are actually seeing it. So the operators that have now reported are talking about upgrade rates or phone sales that should go up.
Right.
And they're saying, like, look, we can't even tell you where the demand's going to end up being because we're still not getting enough supply from Apple to really fully judge this.
Yeah, it's a terrible problem. I'd short the stock.
Exactly.
Walter, free cash flow, 43, 46, 50, 70. And then the modeling of Wall Street is for a diminishment of cash flow. Do you buy that, or does the juggernaut continue?
I mean, the margins, obviously the concern was about 50 basis points, nothing. That's not something that's going to crush their ability to generate free cash flow. Taxes were ticking up a little bit, but again, marginally, not something that's going to change the cash flow. The interesting thing was, we were thinking that they were going to buy $10 billion of stock back, and I think they only bought about four. Six. So four less than we expected. So the cash position went up to $150 billion. So the cash is actually rising at a time when, you know, Cook on the call last night again brings up, well, we're intensely interested in these things. So you have to wonder, again, what are they doing with their cash? Dividend, maybe increase the dividend, maybe acquisitions, we'll have to say.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role is to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. A David Kostin is a mathematician from Brown University. He has the joy as a strategist of actually doing securities analysis before he was a guru, which makes for a different language and different work. David, thrilled to have you with us with Goldman Sachs. Of course, I've been watching the earnings, and the new for me is next to no growth up top, and every quarter, every company's manufacturing down the income statement. The money question for me for next year: partial differentials, unit dynamics, price dynamics up at the revenue line. You got to get down to EBITDA, whatever margin you want to pick. Is there enough wiggle room forward to keep that shell game going, or have they cost cut their way to maximum efficiency?
Well, with apologies to your pejorative question, I think there's enough wiggle room. Yes, the margins are likely to remain flat. And that's an important issue to think about, that with the U.S. economy growing at around 2%, that means the top line revenue growth, if we include some inflation here as well, you're looking at modest top line growth, call that 4%, a little faster from overseas. So that's your revenue line growing in the 4%, perhaps 5% level broadly across the market. And margins are likely to have peaked either late this year or sometime in 2017, depending on the individual sector of the market. But broadly speaking, markets margins have been flat for about 5 years. And it's been technology margins. The technology margins have been the key driver of why overall margins have basically been coming
up.
But
I looked at Pepsi Cola. I looked at that company and it really stuck out to me. This game of making the margin down below, given that there's next to no revenue. Do they have the wiggle room forward to continue to manufacture decent operating income, decent EBITDA, whatever?
Well, from an earnings point of view, certainly buybacks has been a contributor to faster earnings growth. Your revenue growth growing very, very modestly, and there's been some margin. Whatever margins they've been able to eke out have been largely from buybacks and more technology spending to try to eke out singles and doubles, basically. It's been a tough operating environment, and the market has reflected that.
How does real GDP growth affect the markets? I know you've been modeling this. If that changes, what effect does that have on the markets?
So the way to think about real GDP growth is every 100 basis points, every 1 percentage point faster or slower growth is going to add roughly $5 a share to earnings. And let's use a base of about $105. So that gives you an immediate translation of how to think about your impact on faster or slower GDP growth. The way to think of impact on earnings, and about 70% of the revenues of U.S. corporations are domestic. And so therefore, the most important driver of sales, of margins, of earnings for companies is the broad growth, pace of growth in the economy. And the economy right now is growing at about 2%. Not a super fast growth rate, clearly, but also it's not in contraction, so it's growing at a muted level, and that is what has created the idea of what Larry Summers terms the secular stagnation, the idea that no matter how low rates are, it's not inducing corporations to be investing money, and so they've been pretty reluctant, and that's what keeps growth slow.
David and I were talking about what to talk to you about. I've got to ask you about M&A without talking specifically about telephone or Time Warner. Does this game just continue because Janet Yellen has made money so cheap that there's no growth? I got to buy something to keep the game going.
Well, if we think about the waterfall, and that's a good description, waterfall of the preferred uses of cash, most companies' first use is capital spending. And companies are spending a lot on CapEx for maintenance. That's first. Second is research and development. And the third is M&A. Those are the three initiatives that most companies pursue in terms of growth. And so the idea of allocating capital to M&A makes sense in an environment where interest rates, as you point out, are very low, and you can finance transactions at attractive levels.
Do big transactions like this work in the Kostin History Library? Is there a successful merger outcome? Big deals.
There are some combinations that make strategic sense in terms of the business profile of individual companies.
Right.
We've done a lot of work on spinoffs, and so, so oftentimes you have a combination, then that leads to a spinoff of another division.
Right.
So there's often investment opportunities around those.
Yeah.
But it depends. In some cases, there's a long approval process that has taken place, and that makes the investment process a little more difficult.
Just very quickly, your 30 seconds, David Kostin on the general market, buy, hold, or sell. Can you acquire shares today?
You are looking at a modest increase over the next 12 months. You're looking at single digit, call it 5% type of return. So you can call that buy in the context of other opportunities, but it's still relatively modest in terms of historical returns.
John, that seashore you're looking at in New Jersey looks better and better.
I have some oceanfront property I'd like to say.
Very good. David, thank you so much. David Kostin with Goldman Sachs. Can't say enough about the acuity of his research. Jonathan Miller, it's been way too long since we've spoken to you. To our global audience, you have been out front in the real estate slowdown in New York and I think maybe San Francisco. Is it everywhere else, or is it just contained to the stupidity of these two zip codes?
I think it's not, first of all, we don't want to insult those two zip codes, but...
Sure we do. I can't afford them.
So what we're seeing is more of a slowdown in higher priced housing markets, higher cost housing markets.
Is it trickling down?
We're seeing a little bit of that actually. So what we've been seeing in these markets is an increase in resale inventory, which has slowed down the frenetic pace. Bidding wars aren't what they were, but they're still above average. The way I describe the market right now in general, we're somewhere between white hot and above average.
Okay, that's a nice character there. Are the vectors of owning a home the same as renting a home right now, those two separate markets that you deal in?
Yes, absolutely. It's still much cheaper to buy. The problem is, and this is on a national front, is inventory is very tight. So we're seeing, you know, affordability being challenged. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Throw in tight credit on the bank lender side, and it's still the same story.
Mm-hmm. Sort of your most recent note, it was about Greenwich, Connecticut, a town founded in 1640, if I'm not mistaken, and you call it a hotbed of new urbanism. What's going on in Greenwich?
Well, what's been fascinating about the suburbs that ring New York City, especially the high-end markets, is you can see even the suburban towns are placing emphasis on in-town development, proximity closer to the commuter lines to get into the city. It's not this. It's not your grandmother's neighborhood, so to speak. What we're seeing also is in markets like Greenwich is there's an incredible disconnect between, meaning many sellers there are still priced or anchored to 2007, and that market never really saw the boom that we saw in the city. And part of it is because consumer tastes have changed. The city, the high end, has poached some of the high end demand from the suburbs.
So inventory not a problem in Greenwich, say?
It is. I wouldn't say it's not a problem, but I would say it's not. It's not limited. We don't have limited supply there. The way to describe Greenwich and other high end housing markets in the suburban areas is just like the city. They're soft at the top. Mm. So there's very tight inventory, lower, you know, entry middle markets, and it's very soft at the high end. There are transactions. There are high end sales.
You're so prestigious, Jonathan Miller, Miller Samuel, that when you're quoted in whatever rag you're quoted in, 1,000 people in New York stand up and go, "He's an idiot," and they do that because nobody believes what you're talking.
Wait a second. Tom Keene just called me an idiot?
John, no one buys the slowdown idea.
Thanks for coming in.
Define the top market. 6 million and up?
For Greenwich?
No, for the real world here.
Well, the
real world here, the top, what we call the luxury market, top 10% is north of about 4.2 million.
4.2 million. What's a monthly mortgage on 4.2 million?
Many buyers in that market.
No mortgage.
Right. About 80% of them don't have mortgages. Okay. So it's a cash market.
I want to come back very quickly here. Do you see that trickling down to mere mortals? I mean, Michael Barr's trying to slip into 3 bedrooms, 2 fireplaces for what, 700 a month or something, Michael, you're looking at?
At least 675.
I mean, you live out past Akron, Ohio, right?
I'm competing with bears.
Does it trickle down? You are.
Yeah, we absolutely are seeing some of that. It takes a while because you're really looking, at least in New York, the development community has taken about 2 years.
Okay. That's where I want to go. Because okay. David Gura needs a new place. He's making kids so fast.
Oh, my God.
He needs a new place out in the land of Jonathan Miller. Jonathan, I'm looking at $10,500 a month. It's a duplex in Brooklyn. Screams David Gura. There's a balcony with a kale patch on it where he can grow his artisanal kale. It's a modern new building. You have told us years ago, one of the big value adds of having you on is the boroughs in every city are going to build new condo-y-like property to house people. Is there really going to be a glut? Do you really buy that?
There already is as you move to the very high end of the market. Then glut is a harsh word, but it's certainly there's much more supply than there is as you move lower in price. In fact, the problem is that because there's been so much emphasis on luxury rental development, that middle and entry level markets have basically had static housing stock, which has forced many to move to the suburbs and become first time buyers.
And you mentioned on the break Westchester.
Yes, Westchester in the third quarter, and this has been going on for about five quarters.
That's in Pennsylvania?
That is in New York.
Watch it, Wes. We have four sponsors up there. Be nice.
That had the most sales in 35 years.
David Gura, what's really interesting about this is Scarlett Fu's house has not gone up in Westchester because of the ice rink in the backyard.
I see. She's filling it with the garden hose day in and day out.
It's inevitable David will be moving. more kid, you'll be out.
But what's interesting, even with that flood of volume over the last year and a half, you're really not seeing housing prices rise much yet. There was a lot of slack, so to speak, in the suburban markets, and I think it's going to take another year or two before we see a lot more price pressure like we're seeing in the city.
Well, let's talk affordable housing broadly construed. As Thomas pointed out, I do live in Brooklyn. I'm on the Park Slope listserv, and I'm amused always when there is the ad for the bus tours of the suburbs that you can take. There is a point at which people begin to weigh the serious move out to Maplewood or to Montclair.
That reminds
Montclair
me of the foreclosure bus tours they had during the height of the foreclosure bubble.
They exist, and I wonder when that tipping point is going to be, that you have neighborhoods, people like to be in these neighborhoods because of who's in the neighborhoods. This is a city that's really wrestling with this problem right now.
Oh, yes, and I think this is what almost every municipality in the United States is wrestling with right now is affordable housing, and affordable housing not in terms of government subsidized, but in terms of middle class and working class housing. What we're seeing in for example, your market in Brooklyn is this outward radial push. So right now, Queens is setting all-time price records from the Brooklyn spillover.
Are we going to see a national policy? I mean, we make jokes about this, but this is not funny.
It's awful.
People are spending 50% plus. And I get letters from people. This is not about New York, San Francisco, Washington, and Boston. It's nationwide.
Right.
Are you going to see a housing policy for people that, I make jokes about $10,500 a month. Come on.
Right.
Are we going to see a policy?
I think we can only see a policy when somebody actually figures it out. There's been a lot of discussion about this over the last few years, and no real concrete solutions. One of the big items, I think, would be to figure out a way to normalize credit so that we don't create this tightness of inventory. And I think, when you have tight credit, unusually low interest rates, it really has caused development to focus on the top of the market nationwide.
Has the sell to buy gotten more difficult to make? In other words, I'm renting in Brooklyn. I know many people who are, and the prospect of buying just isn't there. Is that changing? Are people more content renting than they have been in the past? Do you expect that's a trend that's going to continue?
I don't know if it's content. It's more that they really
resigned. I guess you.
Yeah, I think resigned is a better word, and that's why we're seeing this phenomenon. People like yourself, and it's not even that rents are rising. It's just that they're high.
Right.
The way I describe the rental market in New York is a high plateau. in real estate, we tend to be very linear. When rents stop rising, that means they're going to fall. But that doesn't appear to be the case because we're 5 years ahead of population projections from the census. We have a record number of employees. There's just a mismatch between the jobs we're creating and the housing that we're creating.
When you look at, you know, let's go to, you know, Westchester, the suburbs of New Jersey. John, you were mentioning the airfield today.
Yeah.
We used to land airplanes.
Yeah, this was out in the good old days in Colts Neck, New Jersey, learned to fly, and we would land in a cornfield.
You'd land in a cornfield.
We don't need a stinking runway.
If you go out to Colts Neck, you know, wherever it is, it's across the Hudson, right?
Yeah, it's in central New Jersey.
What is the market like there, John Miller?
It's a similar situation. It's much like Fairfield County where Westchester. Yeah. Where you're having heavy sales volume, but when you skew to the top of the market, that's where it's softest. This is not just a New York thing. This is what we're seeing. We're seeing that in San Francisco. We're seeing it in L.A., where the suburban markets are really starting to boom because the role of new urbanism has almost been too successful. The walkability that, you know, the supply hasn't been able to react to demand in the right way.
David, I know this is sacrilege for you, but a large part of our audience is going, excuse me, you don't need a granite counter.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of people saying that, you know, I remember the linoleum was ripped up on the kitchen floor and it wasn't a big deal. Right, John? Help me here.
I built my own counter, actually.
Yes. He made the granite.
Yeah, but a lot of that time comes down to the cost of land. The cost of land is what's driving the end product.
John Miller, there's never enough time. No. Thank you so much. Come back when prices go down.
Yeah. You bet.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.